Ms. Bezek?
May it please the court, Mr. Russell Weiss will argue for appellant, Ms. Linda Moore will argue for appellee.
All right, Mr. Rice.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to review some of the factual outline of this case to try to tie it all together. There's various causes of actions that were alleged. In 1998, Ms. Rice purchased coverage from MetLife through her employer with a $50,000 rider for her spouse. The terms of that rider entailed that it would be canceled upon her retirement, but he would have the opportunity to obtain individual coverage. In March of 2003, Ms. Rice did retire from Avon Products, and at that point in time, that's when that rider would expire. In May of 2003, Met offered a retention of the policy, which presumably included the rider, and I would refer the court to, in the appellate's brief, tab 3, page 23 through 26. And at the time that was offered, it was given a choice by Ms. Rice whether she was to retain the coverage or whether she could let it lapse, cash out what was in her cash fund, or simply go on as the way she was had been billed. There was no billing for the rider. Actually, the rider was continually billed until September of 2005. So that's approximately 2.5 years after the date Ms. Rice retired, again, in direct conflict with the terms of the policy certificate that would say that the rider expired upon retirement. Ms. Rice then makes her an inquiry to Met when she receives the no billing notice in September of 2005 that the rider is not included on the billing. MetLife then says, well, your coverage was canceled in July of 2005, and at that time they refused to issue a refund for the premiums that had been paid, and they also refused to allow Mr. Rice to apply for individual coverage. Furthermore, there was no notice of cancellation at that point in time. Appellants then sued for various causes of action, bad faith, breach of contract, promissory estoppel, violation of the DTPA, both the laundry list and unconscionability, violation of the Texas Insurance Code, breach of fiduciary duty, fraud by nondisclosure, and money hadn't received. Appellees moved for summary judgment. The trial court granted summary judgment on all grounds, some of which are traditional, some are no evidence. To summarize most of MetLife's defense to this is that, first and foremost, they're saying that the billing was a mistake, that the 2.5 years of billing after Mrs. Rice's retirement was simply a mistake. And they're also arguing that the terms of the policy or the original certificate cannot be waived because you cannot waive certain terms in a policy to create coverage. Now, in the Ulico-Cass case, the Supreme Court addressed this issue and addressed the waiver issue and basically has stated that if you've got an existing right or benefit, which is an advantage that's held by one party, and that party actually has knowledge of the benefit, as MetLife certainly would here. They have the knowledge of the benefit to be able to cancel the rider, and they choose not to do so, then they have waived that. But they kind of put another stipulation on it. The next stipulation is that it has to prejudice the insured, that the actual waiver had to, or the insurer's actions did. And that's exactly what happened in this case. If you refer to the letter from MetLife on tab 3, page 23, it mentions that congratulations on your retirement at the very top of the letter, and it says you can go on and continue your coverage. We want to keep promises that we've made to you, and at the top of that, it says that the spouse term face amount is $50,000. Okay, at the point in time when that occurred, Ms. Rice had been retired for two months. So technically, the contract had expired. The rider was canceled per the terms of the certificate. If you go on to the next page, it shows what the quarterly cost of the insurance will be for her, and then the first premium payment, which includes the payment for the rider also. Waiver is a question of fact at the point in time for the fact finder, and it's to be determined by the party's silence or inaction if it's been a long period of time. And the trial court found no question of fact for this case, and neither did they find that the insured's actions, the insurer's actions, prejudiced the insured, and felt that that was not the case either. Appellants clearly were prejudiced by this because they had paid premiums in for 2.5 years. They had not sought coverage elsewhere, and due to Mr. Rice's health condition and his age, they were not able to obtain coverage elsewhere. Now, that's very prejudicial in the fact that if you're dealing with a senior citizen, as everyone is well aware, premiums go up and sometimes coverage is not even available for life insurance. Definitely a fact issue exists, and the summary judgment should not have been granted on that ground. Moving on to the other causes of action, and some of these you kind of have to keep the waiver in the back of your mind, but if you go to the bad faith cause of action, if waiver applies, and you can actually make a determination whether there was they had already waived that term, then you've got an issue as to whether it was reasonable for them to cancel the policy. Now, there's some confusion in appellee's brief where they addressed the bad faith issue in stating that, well, the cancellation was valid because it was done by the terms of the original certificate. And if that's the case, and we were dealing in a vacuum just with their certificate, that might make sense. But again, you've got this affirmative action by the insurer 2 months after the retirement date. So the triggering event of the expiration of the rider had already occurred. And at that point in time, they let the premiums bill and received the premiums for 2.5 years. And at that point, after that 2.5 years, the question is, was it reasonable for them to cancel the policy? The Supreme Court's also pointed out in the Lyons case that it's not a question as to whether they even had a right to cancel the policy. You could have contractually the right to do so, but if it was not reasonable given the circumstances of the transaction, then that can be a violation of bad faith. And we certainly believe that a fact question exists as to whether it was reasonable to cancel a policy after 2.5 years of billing the premiums.
But specifically, your waiver argument goes to the policy's right to terminate automatically upon retirement. Is that correct?
Well, in a way. And the Supreme Court was a very difficult opinion in Ulico because they explain the whole history of waiver and estoppel, and then they kind of mix it up as it seems that every court does. But you're dealing with an issue that was 2 months after the event, okay? And so even you have actually two options there. If the waiver, if you're not dealing with an event, let's just say they kept billing and there wasn't ever an affirmative act by the insurer, you have a waiver claim, but you're going to have to show that it prejudiced you. And I think for a fair reading of the case law is telling you also, you're going to have to show that there was an affirmative act by the insurer, probably, as if they were defending someone, as in the facts of the Ulico case, and at the same time also seeking to deny coverage. But after that two-month period, the contract, the certificate, is actually expired when it comes to that rider. And so you've got a wholly new event in May of 2003, which is almost as if, and that's later in the brief we addressed this, as an implied contract without that term, because that term couldn't possibly even be included because it had passed 2 months prior. So you can't say that we're going to give you insurance, but the rider expires when you retire if you'd already retired 2 months prior. In other words, that's basically as much waiver as you can possibly have. Moving on to the breach of contract claim, you have obviously the same argument in addressing the waiver issue. If waiver does apply, then you definitely have evidence as to a breach of contract. Regardless of whether the waiver applies or the issue of waiver applies, part of the original certificate requires that you know when the rider was canceled, because one of the terms in that certificate says that an individual, the spouse, who now has no coverage because of retirement, has a 31-day period after that to elect individual coverage. And the wording of the certificate basically lays out, all you've got to do is say that you want it. Well, that works real well if you know when it was canceled. And it's undisputed, and Met has also put this in their brief, that coverage continued until July of 2005. Well, that's, again, 2.5 years after the retirement date. So the Rices certainly would have no knowledge of when it was actually supposed to cancel. And furthermore, because of the quarterly billing, you don't get a bill until the end of September. And so if you start with July, by the 1st of August, your 31 days is up to get that individual coverage. And so Met's off the hook, yet you don't even discover that until the end of September when your next quarterly bill comes out. The interaction can certainly be deemed as an implied contract at the point in time in May of 2003 when they offered the coverage to Ms. Rice. There's evidence that exists pertaining to a new contract, an assurance of coverage that she lays out in her affidavit, and the failure to give the notice of the cancellation, which may be tantamount in this case. Promissory estoppel is an alternative pleading where if you don't have the contract, you still have promises that were made by the insurance company. In May of 2003, they promised to cover Mr. Rice. And that they backed that up with collecting 2.5 years' worth of premium. That's not a contractual issue. MetLife may be able to be relieved from a contractual obligation by using the certificate and hanging their hat on the actual express contract, but it doesn't negate the reliance damages that the plaintiffs had in this case based on the promises they had made in May of 2003. And obviously, our point of view is a fact issue exists as to that, and therefore summary judgment was improper on that cause of action also. Going to the DTPA and the laundry list, a very important distinction here, and one thing that appellees want you to focus on is all we're talking about is the certificate. Well, that's not true. In May of 2003, again, there were representations made that Mr. Rice and Mrs. Rice both had a policy. They relied on those representations. And for a 2.5-year period, MetLife continued to collect premiums. By representing that and then pulling it back later in July of 2005 and saying the coverage did not exist anymore, they've misrepresented the terms of the policy. They've misrepresented the characteristics or benefits of the policy, which is a laundry list violation. They have misrepresented that you have a right to convert to an individual policy. There's some evidence, obviously, that misrepresentations were made and that those are DTPA violations. We feel that the court erred in granting summary judgment on those grounds. Further, for conscionability, the crux there is that you're dealing with an insured that doesn't have the full knowledge that the insurer does. The insurer is in control of the billing. They've written the policy. They apparently are determining when they're going to accept premiums, when they're not, when they're going to cancel coverage. All you have is the insured receiving a bill, paying the bill, and expecting to be covered. You also have the violations of the Texas Insurance Code, and we believe that those facts, again, in May of 2003 were misrepresentations as to the terms of the policy. You have a breach of fiduciary duty issue, and there's a fact question in that one as to whether it was a confidential relationship. Ms. Rice, as in her affidavit, stated that she was a customer of MetLife throughout her life, and she was shocked with the way their actions were, and that from the parent's statements, that was a trusting relationship. The fraud by non-disclosure is the same kind of situation, whether it was a confidential relationship. She'd been a customer of MetLife throughout her life and under this policy for almost 8 years. And finally, to address the damages, not knowing whether the court actually was the ruling on the MSJ was a rather straightforward, a two-sentence ruling. We obviously think there were damages there in that paying of premiums, the loss of the opportunity to obtain coverage over a period of time, and the loss of the opportunity to have the individual coverage which Met originally offered.
And is your claim about loss of opportunity to get additional coverage because of a change in the husband's condition between the May 2003 date and July of 2005?
No, and that the loss of the opportunity is that, you, in a way, Your Honor, because you do have a passage of time, and I think it's just a general consensus that life insurance is more difficult to get the older you get, regardless of your health. You're a greater risk. But furthermore, that loss of the opportunity to obtain that individual coverage that Met has already said they will give you, all you've got to do is apply for it at the 31-day period before that's up. But you've got to know when the period is, and you also would have to know that it had been canceled.
Thank you. Ms. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The plaintiff's various causes of action have been asserted to attempt to create coverage that simply does not exist here. In making their argument...
I'll keep you the premiums.
Pardon me?
And why did you keep the premiums?
They have been returned. And if you go through the facts and even the hearing... on their motion for new trial, we thought we had returned the premiums because we certainly submitted a check to Mr. Rice. What was not, what did not occur, and let me, that's what I was going to say, they are blurring the lines here between Mrs. Rice's group universal life coverage and this rider for term life coverage for Mr. Rice. Under the group life coverage, universal life, there is an accumulation fund. And consequently, MetLife thought that the premiums went back into that accumulation fund. After the lawsuit, we paid the premiums directly to the Rices, and this group universal life accumulation fund was supposed to recalibrate. It did not. They raised that issue in their motion for new trial. After learning it 7 months before, they waited till the motion to new trial. They did not pursue it with the trial court. We paid it. There is evidence in our supplemental response to their motion for new trial that shows that we paid it, and they don't dispute that at this point. But in any event, even if we had, it would not create coverage. There is, in fact, the Mitchell case that we cite that is a somewhat similar case in that there was group coverage through the city of Dallas, I believe, and that it was due to end any time an employee reached the age of 65. Mr. Mitchell reached the age of 65. Premiums continued to be paid. And then he died, so a claim was made. Even though premiums had been paid, the insurance company denied the coverage or the claim because there was no coverage. You can't create the coverage by waiver or estoppel. The appellants rely upon the Ulico casualty case, but it very much supports exactly MetLife's position in this case. The other thing that they do is argue that MetLife told them that Mr. Rice's coverage continued. If you look at the documentation that Mr. Rice mentioned in his argument, all of this is directed towards Mrs. Rice and her options after she retired. There's no question that the rider says it ends. The rider for the dependent life coverage ends when she retires. The documentation to her afterwards lets her choose if she wants her GUL to continue, if she wants a cash payment of whatever is in her accumulation fund. She has three or four options there. She initially determined that she did not want anything. She just wanted the cash paid to her. Then she changed her mind. And the communications with her about that were, your coverage, Mrs. Rice, is in place. And that's true still to today. So the way that they attempt to blur the facts here, the distinction needs to be made that we're talking about two different coverages. Clearly, waiver and estoppel do not apply, and as Mr. Rice stated, his causes of action that he's asserted, he believes, rest on that. The cases are simply just very clear that it does not apply. With regard,
is he correct in stating that he had 31 days to opt for his own coverage and never got notice that the premiums he was paying were not for that coverage?
The policy does have a conversion provision. The rider does have a conversion provision that allows insured to convert that coverage once Mrs. Rice retired. And it does provide for 31 days. Obviously, that did not happen because the premiums continued for 2 years. The evidence in the record shows.
Obviously, it did not happen because he continued to pay premiums. Now I'm really confused.
Oh, well, the issue is that in December of 2005, when Mrs. Rice talked to MetLife, they told her that he could convert. The plan provides that they have to make the application. MetLife does not have to give notice. There is no requirement that MetLife give notice. And that's typical in these group plans. There simply is no requirement.
Did you say he could have converted in 2005?
Yes, ma'am. He could have. There is no evidence that Mrs. Rice or Mr. Rice ever contacted MetLife to convert. All they say is MetLife never contacted us to convert. She was told, she admits in her affidavit in the record, that she was told that he could convert. MetLife stated in its affidavits that and based on the telephone conversation that she had with MetLife, that she was told, you now have time to convert.
So, but in 2005, what is that 31 days from? I mean,
being told.
From being told.
Right.
In a telephone conversation?
Correct.
Okay.
So, they had several options. If the Rices, Ms. Rice, there again, admits that she had a copy of the coverage,
So if they hadn't filed suit, y'all would have continued to collect the premiums because you said you didn't return them until after they filed the lawsuit. If they hadn't filed the lawsuit, you would have continued to collect the premiums and just refused to pay when he died, claiming that there was no contract?
No, Your Honor. We stopped the billing for premiums in 2005. This lawsuit was filed much later.
But you continued to accept the premiums.
For Mrs. Rice's GUL coverage.
Well, I thought he also was paying for they were also paying for the
rider.
No,
those stopped. We stopped billing. Oh, okay. Yes, she continued paying the same amount, which it was a group universal life policy where you can put more in to build up your cash accumulation.
Why would you do that?
Well, number one, to pay ahead of your premiums. Lots of people do so that you can skip paying premiums. But there's also, it's a universal life, so there's a small investment element there.
So after they filed the lawsuit, you realized that it was premiums and not additional payments, and that's why you returned the money?
No, we returned. They were saying that we had never returned the premiums with regard to the dependent coverage. We decided to go ahead and do that at that point, to just go ahead and write a check to them. It was about just over $2,000.
Let me ask you this. Let's say she has a $100,000 life insurance policy.
Her group Universal Life?
And she's putting all this money in. When she dies, how much money do you distribute?
You would distribute $100,000, and then if there is any amount in the cash accumulation fund, it would be added on to that amount.
So, and the cash accumulation fund is any amount above the premium?
Correct. That would
so
be distributed.
So you don't distribute the money plus the interest on... All right, is there interest paid on the accumulation fund?
I don't know exactly what the investment element is on that, Your Honor, but yes, I mean, there's some, and I don't know if it's interest, if it's money market type return. I honestly don't know with regard to that, but that's a good point. If she had died, then yes, the amount paid to the beneficiary would have been $100,000 plus whatever was in the cash accumulation. So with regard to the alleged misrepresentations that go to the violations of the DTPA and the Texas Insurance Code, there simply weren't any, because if you look at her affidavit, if you look at the documents attached, MetLife was talking about her group universal life coverage. There's clearly no breach of fiduciary duty or fraud by non-disclosure simply because Met did not breach any of those duties it had with regard to that, but also there wasn't a confidential relationship. This was a group plan benefit that she received at Avon. The actual policyholder is trustee of a MetLife insurance trust. The evidence that Mr. Rice alluded to in his argument with regard to MetLife, that Mrs. Rice had been a longtime customer of MetLife, she simply says that she's been a customer of MetLife throughout, at times during her lifetime, has no details. It certainly doesn't give or create a fact issue as to whether or not there was any type of confidential relationship. Just going back to Mr. Rice's argument that MetLife refused to refund the premium, it did not. It, as I said, was in the cash accumulation fund and then subsequently actually paid out. Or that it refused to allow, I believe he said, Mr. Rice to apply. He never did apply or attempt to convert to an individual policy. So there simply are no facts here or evidence that create any fact issues. Additionally, as to the damages or alleged damages, there was no claim made during the 2 years that premiums were accepted. Based on the fact that he never applied for conversion to an individual policy, I don't think that there are no damages. There's no evidence of any damages as to a loss of opportunity.
What happened to the interest on those premiums?
Pardon me?
What happened to the interest on those premiums?
It was paid to the Rices.
Yes. They got the premiums plus the interest.
And there's some evidence in the record with regard to the amount of the interest that was paid. Yes, ma'am. Is there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Mr. Rice, rebuttal.
If I may, in an effort to clear up a couple of questions, the first is that I will refer you to, again, please look at tab number 3, page 23. It clearly has on that, that is an offer to convert your coverage or pull out of the GUL coverage and continue your coverage. You can have a cash out option or pick an annuity. On the top of the page, it says spouse term face amount $50,000. It clearly is part of what they're offering there. The next page, which was included in the mailing, says continue my GUL coverage. The new quarterly cost of your insurance will be $462.12. The first premium payment of $616.16 is due within 30 days. That premium payment includes the cost of the individual insurance and also the insurance for that rider. And so in May of 2003, 2 months after Mrs. Rice had retired, MetLife made an affirmative action offering the life insurance as it stood at that time with the rider and with the individual coverage and said, here's what we're offering you, and here's what we're doing as far as billing you for your premiums, and this is when your premium is going to be due. The argument that the case rests on waiver is simply untrue. You have a waiver analysis when you're looking at the express contract and whether those terms were waived. There's DTPA violations here that occurred in May of 2003, and if we follow Met's argument, the rider was gone. It had expired in March of 2003. That everything was just a mistake at that point. And what we're arguing is it was a mistake. They made affirmative statements that the coverage would continue, and then they billed for 2.5 years, and they accepted premiums. They did return the premiums finally, as far as we understand. They apparently have computer problems, albeit after 3 years, they finally did that. There's a reference that counsel made to extending the time limit of the ability to convert, the 31-day period. And I had talked about the question of when does that 31 days begin. There's absolutely nothing in the record, and I implore your honors to review this, that shows that they extended anything. There is nothing in any affidavits. There is no summary judgment proof. And there's certainly nothing in Mrs. Rice's affidavits where she admits she had an opportunity to convert. When she discovered that the billing error, and she called in December of 2005 and said, why are you not billing me for my spouse's rider? They said, the insurance was canceled in July of 2005, and you had 31 days, and you're out of time. And she says, what about the premiums? I paid all those premiums. Well, he was covered up till 2005. And at that point in time, we'll have an agent contact you to see if you want coverage. That is what is in the affidavit. There is certainly no admission that they chose to forego the 31-day opportunity. Also to address the special relationship or a confidential relationship, on a summary judgment level, you have to merely satisfy that there's more than a mere scintilla of evidence. In Mrs. Rice's affidavit, she's stating that she's been a MetLife customer throughout her life for several times and that she was shocked at the way she was treated. That is at least a scintilla of evidence. But there's no evidence of conversion. There's obviously evidence of damages, and we would address that the waiver certainly does apply under the Ulico case. But even if the court does not look at it from that point of view, the actions in May of 2003 start everything over, and any statements made at that time can be a basis for a TTPA claim, can be a basis of a breach of fiduciary duty claim, certainly a fraud claim. And how can you ever apply for coverage if you don't know when it's canceled? Of course, that has to be an essential term to a contract, that when we cancel, you've got 31 days, but we aren't going to tell you when we're going to cancel. So on one end, Met's going to say, the rider tells you 31 days after retirement. And then on the other side, they're saying, well, you were really covered until July of 2005. If that was the case, where's the cancellation notice that goes out in the mail? MetLife was never able to produce any kind of notice that they received. The case law says that's a fact question if the plaintiff is saying, or the insured is saying, we didn't receive the notice. And they could have simply overcome that by producing the notice. But you've got fact questions all over this case. Well, thank you for your time. And
I have a follow-up question. On this May 10th, 2003 letter, which you've referred to several times in oral argument. Is it your position that really creates another offer to the Rices that then takes it out of the automatic termination provisions of the underlying policies?
I think it does one of two things, exactly either that, because obviously you've got the elements of a contract here. You've got an offer, an acceptance, and then you've got a performance by both parties from that period in time. Med admits there was coverage to July 05. The plaintiffs admit they paid the premiums. Okay, you've got a contract right there. But even with that, in May of 2005, you've also got an example of what they are no longer including, because the key term here, the basis of the case, is that rider. And so if you've now got a transaction that is occurring after the triggering event that expires the rider, they can have done nothing but waive that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rice. Thank
you,
Ms. Moore. Your case is submitted. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments today. We will take a 10-minute recess, and we'll pick up with our third case, Stewart v. Langdon.